Bon, alors merci et bonjour. On va continuer avec le programme parce qu'on a quand même des conférenciers très intéressants. Alors, c'est vraiment pour moi un honneur de co-présider cette conférence de l'Institut sur l'étude du Canada, ici à McGill, et la Fondation Jeanne Sauvé. Nous sommes très fiers aussi d'être parmi vous aujourd'hui parce que notre hôte académique, c'est l'Université McGill. Et je suis très contente de voir aussi des boursiers sauvés, des enseignes du programme aussi qui président certaines sessions ce matin. On to the topic at hand, without any further delay, there's no question that the safety of oil in terms of its transportation, its extraction, is front and center when we're speaking about petrocultures. And this really is the heart of the debate. From Lac Mégantic to Fort McMurray, questions of the safety surrounding oil clearly are front and center. But also more broadly speaking, in terms of the broader security of oil, the consumption and production, and what that means for climate change. The word would have been said earlier today had we been able to start on time with our panel. So we will be talking about climate change, certainly in this panel, and that leads me to introduce our first speaker. We will have three speakers. Each speaker will be given 20 minutes. In that 20 minutes, they deliver their remarks and will take questions. Their presentation, we've recommended 10 minutes. If it's less, there's time for more questions. If it's more, there's time for fewer questions. So 20 minutes per speaker. So in terms of our first speaker, vous le connaissez très bien, surtout ici au Québec. Je vous présente Stephen Guilbeault, qui est cofondateur et directeur senior de Équiterre. C'est un environnementaliste de longue date, depuis même les années, avant les années 90 d'ailleurs. Et il a travaillé aussi pour Greenpeace Canada, Greenpeace International pendant 10 ans, avant d'être conseiller senior à Deloitte et Touche en matière de développement durable. Souvent on le lit, on l'écoute, on l'entend et on le voit aussi aux médias, la presse, Radio-Canada, Corporate Knights, Metro ici à Montréal. Throughout his career, Stephen has co-chaired the Climate Action Network International. He did this for 5 years. He's attended the majority of UN climate change meetings, and in fact, an experience that in 2009 served as the focus for his first book. He's a member of Quebec's Cercle des Phénix, which is an honorary society for environmentalists. He's also an honorary fellow of the Royal Canadian Geographical Society. In 2012, the Université de Montréal, which he is a proud alum, awarded him its medal for lifetime achievement. So I believe Stephen's going to address a number of issues, including the broader issue of security and how the development of oil relates to climate change. Stephen, à toi la parole. Ça va être surtout en français, mais peut-être une partie en anglais aussi.
Good morning. So my name is Stephen Guilbeault. I have been asked to speak to you in French. I understand few people have done so. So my presentation will be mostly in French. I can obviously speak in English. I can also take questions in English. It's not an issue, but so let me start right away. Time is short. Alors, la question à laquelle on m'a demandé de répondre ce matin, c'est celle, comme Désiré l'a présenté, de la sécurité du pétrole. Et moi, j'aimerais commencer par regarder ça de façon très large. Pour nous, chez Équiterre, la sécurité liée au pétrole, c'est pas simplement un enjeu d'infrastructure, que ce soit au niveau de l'extraction, du transport, de la distribution du pétrole, mais c'est aussi les effets dans leur ensemble de l'utilisation du pétrole. Et pour nous, en haut de la pyramide de ces effets-là, il y a évidemment la question des changements climatiques et du réchauffement de la planète. Alors, c'est une animation que j'ai empruntée au Département de l'État des États-Unis d'Amérique qui est fait sur la base des scénarios du groupe d'experts intergouvernemental sur l'évolution du climat, qui nous montre l'évolution des températures, donc depuis 1870, Alors, ce qu'on voit, évidemment, c'est que beaucoup, à partir de, après la Deuxième Guerre mondiale, il y a une augmentation rapide des températures moyennes. Et plus ça va, bon, évidemment, quand on va dépasser les années 2010, on entre dans les projections. Alors, on ne sait pas exactement quelles seront les températures en 2030 ou 2050. On utilise des modèles informatiques. On le fait, ce genre de projection-là, on fait ça dans toutes sortes de domaines. On le fait en climatologie, on le fait en économie, on le fait dans bien d'autres domaines. Ce qui est clair pour l'ensemble de la communauté scientifique internationale, c'est que nous nous dirigeons dans un monde où il fera de plus en plus chaud. Et il fait d'ailleurs de plus en plus chaud. En fait, la dernière fois où les températures moyennes sur une base mensuelle à l'échelle planétaire étaient sous les normales, j'avais à peu près 6 ans. Et le disco était la musique qui était très à la mode à cette époque-là. Donc, nous sommes rendus à 340 mois où les températures moyennes planétaires ont été toujours au-dessus des normales saisonnières. Et il faut comprendre le processus par lequel nous sommes arrivés à ce genre de conclusion-là. Donc, c'est le groupe de scientifiques des Nations Unies. L'ensemble des pays de la planète ont appuyé les conclusions des scientifiques, c'est-à-dire que comme c'est un organe des Nations Unies, ils ne peuvent émettre de conclusions, publier des rapports sans que l'ensemble des pays membres des Nations Unies, dont le Canada, dont les États-Unis, dont les pays producteurs de pétrole, ne soient d'accord avec ces conclusions-là. On pourrait parler beaucoup, beaucoup de changement climatique en 10 minutes, et alors que je dois parler d'autres choses, on va devoir aller quand même assez rapidement. Cette fois-là, ce sont une série de photos satellites de la NASA. On a commencé à prendre des photos satellites du cercle polaire en 1979. Et ce qu'il faut comprendre au niveau des changements climatiques, évidemment, c'est les tendances. C'est pas nécessairement les variations d'une année à l'autre, mais quelles sont les tendances? Et dans le cas du cercle polaire, de l'Arctique, on voit très bien quelles sont les tendances. Les négationnistes du climat vont vous dire, ah ben mon Dieu, parce qu'en 2013, il y a eu plus de glace. Et là, ils vont dire, tout va bien, c'est pas vrai, il n'y a pas de changement climatique. En 2013, il y a eu beaucoup de glace en Arctique, mais on voit que les tendances, elles sont très préoccupantes. Il y a des variations importantes d'une année à l'autre, mais au niveau des tendances, c'est très clair. Alors, comment est-ce qu'on en est arrivé là et qu'est-ce qui nous attend? Bien, on le voit de plus en plus, le gouvernement fédéral canadien est devenu une meneuse de claques, ça c'est le terme en français pour cheerleaders, on l'entend moins souvent, mais donc une meneuse de claques pour les compagnies pétrolières, notamment pour la question pour les compagnies de sable bitumineux. Alors, pour ceux et celles qui sont moins familiers avec la question des sables bitumineux, il faut comprendre qu'il y a deux grandes technologies qui sont utilisées. La technologie un peu plus traditionnelle, c'est celle des mines à ciel ouvert. C'est parmi les plus grandes mines à ciel ouvert au monde. Pour vous donner une idée de quoi on parle ici, ce petit camion-là, c'est un camion de 340 tonnes. Qui fait à peu près la hauteur d'un édifice de 3 à 4 étages. Et on en utilise beaucoup de ces camions-là pour extraire les sables bitumineux. Alors, les sables bitumineux, c'est une opération pétrolière, oui, mais c'est également aussi une opération minière. C'est deux opérations industrielles pour le même produit. Il faut énormément d'énergie, il faut énormément d'eau pour produire ces barils-là. On utilise, dépendamment des technologies, je vous disais qu'il y a deux technologies pour extraire les sables bitumineux, quelque part entre 2 et 12 barils d'eau par baril de pétrole extrait. Et qu'est-ce qu'on fait avec cette eau-là, une fois qu'elle est contaminée? Bien, on l'entrepose dans des lacs d'eau artificielle. Il n'y a aucune réglementation présentement au Canada pour forcer les entreprises à nettoyer ça. Que ce soit fédéral ou provincial, les compagnies pétrolières vont vous dire « Oui, mais on recycle l'eau, 80% de l'eau est recyclée dans notre processus industriel. » C'est vrai. Mais on finit quand même par consommer, ces entreprises-là, et on parle d'une dizaine d'entreprises, consomment chaque année l'équivalent de l'eau d'une ville comme Montréal, la deuxième métropole en importance au Canada. Et ces lacs d'eau contaminés-là sont tellement importants qu'on peut les voir de l'espace. Alors, le Canada a maintenant sa contribution au patrimoine mondial en termes de ce qu'on peut voir de l'espace. La Chine peut prétendre qu'on peut voir la Grande Muraille de Chine, mais nous, notre contribution à ce patrimoine-là, c'est qu'on peut voir de l'espace les lacs d'eau contaminés des sables bitumineux de l'Alberta. Alors, C'est très préoccupant. Pourquoi? Parce que le gouvernement fédéral actuel a décidé que nous allions enlever tous les obstacles dans le développement à la fois des sables bitumineux, mais aussi des infrastructures comme les pipelines qui vont permettre l'augmentation de cette production-là. Nous étions, nous, en audience devant l'Office national de l'énergie, où on ne peut parler de la question des changements climatiques. Le gouvernement fédéral, dans le cadre des évaluations d'impact en Alberta, refuse de parler des changements climatiques. Vous pouvez imaginer à quel point le gouvernement albertain est intéressé de parler de changement climatique dans le cadre des évaluations d'impact. Donc, il n'y a présentement au Canada aucune façon d'évaluer les impacts des changements climatiques à travers les processus réglementaires. Alors, comment est-ce qu'on le fait? Bien, on doit le faire à travers des études d'organisations comme l'Institut Pembina qui a rendu public un rapport hier là-dessus. Il y a évidemment la question de la sécurité au niveau de l'utilisation des infrastructures. Je pourrais parler de plusieurs compagnies. On a parlé hier de la compagnie Enbridge, de l'accident de Kalamazoo. Alors, ce que vous avez sur ce graphique-là, donc, l'échelle à droite, c'est le nombre de barils transportés par jour, donc, entre les années 2000 et 2011. On voit que, donc, la colonne en bleu, c'est le nombre de barils transportés. On voit que ça n'a pas beaucoup évolué dans les années 2000. Ce que vous avez en orange avec l'échelle à gauche, c'est le nombre d'accidents par année. Alors, le nombre d'accidents a pratiquement doublé entre 2000 et 2011 chez Enbridge. Et là, ils vont vous dire, oui, mais c'est parce qu'on a changé les règles et que maintenant, il faut rapporter chaque petite fuite qu'il y a. Si c'était juste une question de nombre, mais c'est aussi des quantités faramineuses. On parle de 1,9 million de barils par jour en moyenne par année de fuite chez Enbridge entre 2007 et 2012. Et cette information-là, je ne l'ai pas inventée, c'est sur le site Internet de la compagnie. Il y a énormément d'alternatives. Je ne veux pas vous laisser seulement avec cette idée-là que tout est déjà décidé d'avance. Il y a un rapport très intéressant de la banque HSBC il y a quelques années qui a regardé les plans de relance de plusieurs économies du G20 au niveau d'investissement dans ce qu'on appelle l'économie verte. Alors, l'économie verte, c'est quoi? C'est l'efficacité énergétique, c'est de l'eau plus propre, c'est de l'air plus propre, c'est des transports électriques, les énergies renouvelables. Et ce qu'on voit, c'est que les pays industrialisés, en moyenne, vont investir à peu près 15% de leur plan de relance économique dans l'économie verte. Et ce qui est très intéressant, c'est de regarder des pays comme la Chine, où en pourcentage, c'est pas le pays le plus important, mais c'est 38% en termes absolus. La Chine est en train de devenir vraiment un leader mondial. La Corée du Sud prend depuis quelques années l'équivalent de chaque budget à peu près du gouvernement Harper, donc le prochain budget de M. Flaherty de la semaine prochaine. Regardez les montants qui vont être annoncés, et la Corée du Sud prend la presque totalité de ça pour l'investir dans l'économie verte. Il y a une croissance très rapide au niveau de l'énergie solaire, et la Chine a compris ça. Elle est devenue, en l'espace d'à peine 10 ans, le plus grand producteur, et de loin le plus grand producteur d'énergie solaire au monde. Et si on veut parler de création d'emplois, il y a nos collègues au Canada anglais, la coalition Blue Green Alliance, donc qui est des écologistes et des membres de syndicats qui travaillent ensemble, qui ont comparé en termes de création d'emplois par million de dollars investis. Qu'est-ce qui était le plus intéressant? Alors, si on veut des emplois, c'est pas des investissements dans le pétrole ou le gaz qui est le plus intéressant, mais c'est clairement dans les énergies renouvelables ou encore dans le transport collectif. Il y a des choses très intéressantes qui se passent un peu partout en Amérique du Nord, particulièrement ici. Le Québec a un plan au niveau de l'électrification des transports qui est très intéressant. Pourquoi continuer à utiliser du pétrole quand on peut utiliser une énergie qui est beaucoup plus propre? Quand on peut utiliser un mode de propulsion qui est beaucoup plus efficace, le moteur à combustion interne, la voiture, convertit à peu près 25% de l'énergie en mouvement, alors que le moteur électrique, dépendamment de la technologie, va en convertir 80 à 94%. Alors, pour chaque unité d'énergie, quand on passe du pétrole à l'électricité, on a un gain de déplacement de 3 à 4 fois. C'est quand même incroyable. Et en plus, cette électricité-là, elle est drôlement plus chère. On parle d'à peu près le dixième du prix du pétrole. Alors, pour ça, il faut faire des investissements dans des infrastructures, mais pas des infrastructures de pétrole ou de gaz naturel, mais des infrastructures de transport en commun, des bornes de recharge partout. Et même en région, il y a des projets très intéressants qui voient le jour. Je vous laisse en vous parlant d'un rêve qu'on a eu à Équiterre de faire l'un des édifices les plus efficaces en Amérique du Nord. On a commencé à travailler là-dessus il y a 10 ans et ce bâtiment-là est à quelques centaines de mètres d'ici. C'est la Maison du développement durable. C'est un des 10 édifices les plus efficaces en Amérique du Nord en termes d'utilisation d'énergie par mètre carré. C'est une gang d'écolos qui ont fait ça alors que tout le monde disait que c'était impossible. On a un système de chauffage au gaz naturel qu'on n'a pas utilisé encore depuis 2 ans et demi, tellement l'édifice est efficace pour conserver l'énergie, que ce soit le froid l'été, la chaleur l'hiver. On récupère l'eau de pluie pour les toilettes. On a mis en place toute une série de mesures pour montrer qu'on peut briser avec les vieux paradigmes, qu'on peut faire les choses autrement et qu'on peut les faire de façon beaucoup plus efficace et que c'est à la fois intéressant d'un point de vue social, économique et environnemental. Merci beaucoup.
Steven, là, vous avez pris juste en dessous de 10 minutes, donc on a quand même 10 minutes pour la période des questions. J'ai, en tant que président d'Assemblée, j'ai un peu le devoir de vous poser la première question. Vous avez parlé de l'investissement dans l'économie verte et le Canada se trouve vraiment très bas. Alors, est-ce que vous pouvez peut-être parler de l'aspect politique et comment ça se fait qu'au Canada, ces préoccupations face au changement climatique et l'économie l'économie verte n'ont pas l'air à se transmettre au gouvernement, surtout fédéral. Qu'est-ce qu'on a à faire pour faire transmettre et traduire cette préoccupation-là au niveau politique?
C'est une excellente question. Ça n'a pas toujours été comme ça au Canada. On a déjà été reconnu à l'échelle internationale comme un leader en matière de lutte au changement climatique. L'un des outils environnementaux international les plus efficaces qu'on a conçu jusqu'à ce jour, le protocole de Montréal, a été signé à peu près à 1 kilomètre d'ici. C'est l'un des outils les plus efficaces en matière de lutte environnementale. C'était le gouvernement conservateur de Brian Mulroney qui était derrière ça. Nous avons déjà été un joueur très proactif sur la scène internationale et en matière au niveau national également. Ce n'est plus le cas depuis 2006. On a hélas un gouvernement fédéral en place qui ne croit pas que la question des changements climatiques est un problème, qui ne croit pas aux énergies renouvelables ou encore à l'économie verte, à l'encontre même de tous les faits qui démontrent que c'est la tendance au niveau mondial, que le 21e siècle sera un siècle où l'économie sera une économie de l'innovation, du savoir, et alors que les Chinois, les Européens, les Coréens, les Américains prennent ce virage-là, il se fait deux fois plus d'investissements par personne aux États-Unis dans les énergies renouvelables, dans le capital de risque pour les technologies propres qu'il ne s'en fait au Canada. On ne parle pas au total, là, mais par personne, deux fois plus aux États-Unis. Et ça a commencé sous George Bush, même avant l'arrivée de Barack Obama. Alors, on a un gouvernement fédéral qui fait preuve vraiment d'un blocage idéologique sur ces questions-là. Il y a une majorité de Canadiens qui sont en faveur de ce genre de mesures-là, mais eux, ça ne les intéresse pas. Et on a plusieurs provinces qui sont très actives dans ce domaine-là. La Nouvelle-Écosse en matière d'énergie renouvelable, bon, j'ai parlé du Québec, l'Ontario qui, avec la fermeture de ses centrales au charbon, son programme sur l'économie verte, est en train de faire des choses extraordinaires. La fermeture des centrales au charbon en Ontario, c'est la mesure la plus importante qui a été mise en place en Amérique du Nord pour réduire les émissions de gaz à effet de serre. Et si on ne trouve pas des façons d'arrêter le gouvernement de Stephen Harper, ce qui se passe dans les sables bitumineux va annuler tous les gains qui ont été faits en Ontario, au Québec, au Nouveau-Brunswick, en Colombie-Britannique, en matière de réduction des émissions de gaz à effet de serre. Tout ça pour 10 entreprises.
Merci beaucoup, Stephen. Alors, je veux juste voir, est-ce qu'il y a d'autres personnes, à part de cette personne-là, qui a une question? Does anyone else have a question? If so, I'd ask you to line up the mics now to get a sense in the remaining 6 minutes to make sure we get all the questions in. So we'll go ahead and start here. Yeah.
My name is Daniel Hachikander. I'm an aspiring lawyer. I'm going to ask my question in French, and then I'll maybe just briefly summarize in English. It's going to be a very simple question.
You can ask it in English. That's fine.
Okay. Well, I all right, if you want. So
time is precious.
As an aspiring lawyer and as a legal student, I know that in the court of law, it's very easy to determine who bears the burden of proof, who has to prove, you know, sur qui repose le fardeau. And It's very simple. You just look in the civil code, or you look in the code of civil procedure, and you know who has to prove their case. But in the, let's say, the court of climate change, which obviously doesn't exist, it's not so simple. And we heard Professor Zeman talk about we've had all the IPCC reports, all the Al Gore movies, all the conferences, international treaties and stuff, and people seem just not to get it, let's say. But my question is, you know, precisely on who bears the burden of climate change. I mean, we know who's going to suffer, but is it the people? Is it the governments, the companies? Who should be the first person to act, and who, you know, so qui repose le fardeau, basically?
So, Stephen, I'm going to ask you to keep your thoughts in mind, because we're going to take the rest of the questions, and then we'll do a tour de table at the end. So, please, over to you. Yes.
Hi, I really enjoyed your talk. Thank you very much. It was enlightening. My name is Sonia Kansian, and I'm a historian associated with MISC. And my question is a little bit related to delivery, transportation, and what this does to our daily lives in the future. When we think about how electricity has affected our lives since the Industrial Revolution and earlier, and we think now about petrol, and we think increasingly about making the delivery of petrol faster, much more accessible, increasingly over time. How do we now then envision our future lives? In other words, how does accessibility of this energy, increased accessibility and availability, how will that affect how we perceive and understand how power energy is affecting our daily lives in the future.
Thank you. Thank Stephen, I hope you got that.
Yeah.
I think we have one last question here.
Bonjour, mon nom c'est Abina, je suis étudiante ici en sciences cognitives à McGill, et je suis aussi membre de Davis McGill. I'll ask my question in English, I guess. So you talked a lot about alternative energy sources, and you touched briefly on the government's responsibility to, I guess, go towards these energy sources. And my question is, to what extent do you think lobbying by the oil companies distracts from this, and what solutions would you propose to this kind of lobbying?
Okay, so we have three very meaty questions. I'd say those of you, gentlemen, you can be the first to ask the questions in the next to the next speaker or the ultimate speaker. Stephen, if you could just please answer those three questions.
Who bears the burden? I mean, I think there's various aspects to this question. I think we're all responsible collectively. It's not just governments, it's not just companies, and it's really not just the public. I mean, it has to be. We got into this collectively. We have to get out of it collectively. That being said, our level of responsibility varies greatly depending on where you are on the planet and where you were born. Industrialized countries are basically responsible for about 80% of the historical accumulation of greenhouse gas increased concentrations in the atmosphere. It doesn't mean that, you know, China is let off the hook by saying that, or India, but it means that, you know, there is an environmental aspect to this that's very important, but there's also a moral aspect that we can't simply ignore. Having been to many, the vast majority of UN meetings on climate change, this is something, I mean, to some extent, the environmental aspect of it is fairly easy to come to terms with. The moral aspect and how do you deal with this is far more complicated. I would like to tell you that, you know, we have the solution, and we've tried in Copenhagen in 2009 and came on crashing really badly. I think there is a bit of an appetite now to try and see if we can come up with another global solution. Obviously, once you have a global solution, it still has to be implemented domestically, regionally, municipally. But the next big rendezvous is Paris in 2015, where the international community is hoping to come up with one international agreement where everybody would be that would deal with the situation for every country, from Canada to China. The second question, how does it, I mean, you know, the one thing that oil companies and the Harper government don't want you to know is that oil consumption is actually, it's coming down. In North America, it's coming down in Canada, it's coming down in Quebec. We're consuming less of that stuff. So most of, if not all of these new infrastructure projects, Northern Gateway, Keystone XL, Energy East, Line 9 Reversal by Enbridge, the one thing the one goal that they pursue is for oil companies to make more money by exporting that stuff. So we will be, people along the lines of those pipelines will bear the risks, would bear a few of the benefits. There's this guy in the U.S., what's his name? He said that, you know, a project like Keystone XL in the long term would create about 50 jobs. Oh, he's the president of the United States of America, Barack Obama. That's the guy who said, right, 50 jobs. So is it really worth it? I think that we don't ask ourselves that question often enough. Why are we doing this? Who's going to benefit from this? And I think once we start posing those questions and finding answers, I think that our collective decisions will be much more easier. And I think it brings me to your question about lobbying. What do we do about it? Last year at the United Nations meeting, not the last one, but the previous one, environmental groups met with the very, very unique thing. Environmental groups met with the environment minister. And I, as Desiree was saying, I write in the Montreal Metro. I've been doing it for a long time. And the title of my next column following that meeting was Oil Lobby 54, Environmental Group 1. So the environment minister had met in the year previous to to our meeting, he had met 54 times with oil lobbyists and once with us. We haven't met the new environment minister. I sincerely doubt that she will agree to meet with us. So, I mean, oil companies and oil lobbies are putting a lot of money into this. Like not tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands, but millions, tens of millions of dollars into trying to influence our government. What can we do about it? Well, we have the public on our side. 2 years ago, in the streets of Montreal, we had 300,000 people come out for Earth Day to tell our governments in Quebec City and Ottawa that we want this better world that we've been talking about for so long. Now, that 300,000 people, just imagine, that's about 10% of the greater Montreal entire population. It's not a group of extremists. It's not a bunch of wackos. It's a lot of people who believe in that this can happen and that are getting a bit fed up that lobbies and special interest groups are trying to prevent that from happening.
Merci, Stephen. And someone who participated in that with my children and people with families and strollers, I can say it certainly is a broad-based movement. Stephen referred to meetings with ministers. He has his own meeting with our Minister of Transport shortly, so you'll forgive him. We'll all forgive him for having to leave. Thank you so much for sharing your time and your expertise with us this morning. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you. Our next speaker, we're grateful to have with us two of Canada's most prominent environmentalists, and sandwiched in between, we have a famous, if not infamous, speaker, infamous for his outspoken views and commentary on a whole range of social, political, and indeed environmental issues. Ezra Levant is a TV anchor, newspaper columnist, and author, and general, and this is from your own bio, troublemaker. He is currently a commentator for Sun News, where he hosts the daily talk show The Source. And prior to this, just out of law school, he went on to work in Ottawa as a parliamentary assistant to Preston Manning, who, as you know, founded the Reform Party. It was the first of many romantic but ultimately doomed political campaigns. He went on to join the editorial board of the National Post newspaper, and his beat included national politics, the Supreme Court and the Middle East. In 2004, he became the founding publisher of the Western Standard, and that led to two charges of hate speech before the Alberta government's Human Rights Commission. He went on to write a book called Shakedown, which exposed, in his view, the censorship of Canada's Human Rights Commission. His next book, very relevant to today's topic, is called Ethical Oil, The Case for Alberta's Oil Sands, which was published in 2010 and then won the 2011 National Business Book Award. So, over to you, Ezra Levant, to share your views.
Thanks very much. I have a bet with Martin Patrickin that there will be a second eruption of protesters, and if that happens, I will win a dollar from him. So, Jimmy, if you're going to pull the fire alarm, I'll give you a cut. It's a pleasure to be here in Montreal at McGill, the university that both my mother and my brother went to, which is why they speak such beautiful French, and the only word I know is menu. But I look forward to talking with you. How many minutes do I have? 20 minutes?
20 minutes in total. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I've got a 3-hour speech written, so I'll just try and get through it as fast as I can. This is the book I wrote called Ethical Oil. I actually wrote it by accident. I had written this book about free speech, and I was at the Ottawa Writers Festival, and I was there early. And they said, look, there's some guy downstairs who wrote a book against the oil sands. Why don't you go and debate him? I didn't really know anything about the oil sands, but I tried my best. And I walked in, the room's about this big, and there were pictures all around of this kind of oil sands pornography that Stephen Gilbo was showing. I call it oil sands pornography because it's designed to get an emotional, repulsive reaction. How can you look at something that looks like the land of Mordor and not say, I hate that place? And I made some jokes saying, oh, I see my apartment over there. And I did my best, but I made all the arguments that back home in Alberta, my buddies would say, damn straight, as you tell them. But in this crowd of Ottawa folks at the Writers' Festival went over like a lead balloon. Here's an artist's depiction of me. I had sideburns back then, being chased out of the room. It was a disaster. I mean, why? I think I'm a persuasive guy. I mean, certainly my friends back home in Alberta agree with me. Why did I fail to make the case for the oil sands that day in Ottawa? Well, because of Zoe, really. I mean, that room was full of 20-something university students, never been west of Hamilton, taking vegetarian studies. Let's call her Zoe. There's a lot of boy Zoes, too. I mean, I think there's one or two in this room. And the thing is, I was talking for guys like me, who look and sound like me, you know, fat middle-aged guys from Alberta who like making money. I wasn't talking for Zoe. And I thought, well, hang on. Can a right-wing guy, you know, make the case for the oil sands using left-wing values? I mean, every man in this room knows we spend half our time thinking, what do women want? Well, if a guy can think what women want, can a right-winger from Alberta think, what does Zoe want? What does Zoe care about? Well, I mean, if you ask her, and I think there's a lot of Zoes in this room, they'll tell you. Zoe cares about environmental responsibility. Not just traditional measures like clean air, clean water, and clean oil, but also greenhouse gases. That's Saint Suzuki looking up into that. I'll be with you soon, my fellow angels. But environmental responsibility is not the only thing that Zoe cares about. I mean, look at the word Greenpeace. There's the green part, but then there's the peace part. I mean, Zoe cares about peace. I mean, she'll protest any conflict, really. I mean, and that's great. That's a value that Zoe cares about, too, isn't it? That's not an Alberta right-wing value. That's a Zoe value. Uh-huh. Yeah, you can nod along, Zoe. The treatment of workers. I mean, Zoe lives at home and she works at Starbucks, but she still thinks of herself as standing in solidarity with the proletariat. I mean, they even use that language at McGill still. I'm sure you have a Marxist studies department here. I mean, standing with the treatment of workers. I mean, I do too, by the way. I'm just joking around. But this is something that's very valuable to Zoe. We know that the CEO is going to do well, but how about the guy in the pit digging the oil with the shovel in the mine? Is he going to do okay? And finally, and Zoe, this probably wouldn't be top of mind because we live in a province here with a woman as premier. The top 5 premiers in Canada are all women. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is a woman. The last 2 governors general in this country in a row were women, immigrant women. But human rights, how do we treat people who are weaker than us? How do we treat minorities, women, Aboriginals, gays? This is something that in Canada we take for granted. But so it's sort of like the wallpaper. We don't notice it, but this is actually maybe even the most important value for Zoe. So these four liberal values, not right-wing Ralph Klein, Mike Harris values, but four liberal values: environmental responsibility, peace, the treatment of workers, and human rights. That's how Zoe thinks and talks. And my mistake that day in Ottawa was talking like a right-wing Alberta geologist or something. I mean, one day we'll invent the lithium crystals. Or what were they mining in the movie Avatar? Unobtainium. A fantasy fuel of the future that's perfect in every way. Oh, except it doesn't exist yet. And that happy day, we can all get off oil. But I know every one of you is going to fill up your car with gas probably sometime this week. And until we invent unobtainium, that's going to keep happening. So the choice, I mean, and the one thing about Zoe is she wants to be taken seriously. You know, I mean, and the practical application of ethics is not between some fantasy future and reality. It's between two imperfect choices today. I mean, officially, this is about the safety of oil. Well, I mean, if we look at the safety of any energy source, over 100,000 Americans alone died in coal mines in the 20th century. Every day, dozens of people die in coal mines. We've just come to accept that. I mean, there is a cost to any energy source. Windmills, to get the rare earths mined from China, the people who die in those mines. There is a cost to everything. So to be morally serious, Zoe, we have to choose between two real choices. And I mean, if we were talking about olive oil, buy it from Spain, Italy, Greece, whatever, good people, but we're not talking about olive oil, we're talking oil of the crude variety. And I don't know what God was thinking about when he handed up the stuff, but he gave it to all the world's bastards. Here is a list of the top 10 countries ranked by oil reserves. So it's a snapshot, not just of where oil is coming from now, but where it will come from 10, 20, 50 years in the future. And you will notice that Canada is the only Western liberal democracy on that list. That skull and bones is my own artistic interpretation of the OPEC logo. Russia, of course, run by a former KGB agent, isn't in some little club. He doesn't need to be in an OPEC club to be a tough guy. Look at that list. It is us and the world's worst countries. And so I say to Zoe again, when you go fill up your car, when you get plastic that is made in your iPhone, where do you want it from? Because I know you're not going to go all Unabomber and shrug off any fossil fuel. We live in a cold country. We need it. We heard from our opening speaker about the pipeline from Maine. Montreal runs on conflict oil. The OPEC tankers from Saudi Arabia pull into Portland, disgorge their Sharia oil, their women stoning oil, their union busting oil. It's piped up here, and Mr. Guilbeault uses it in his car. And so, and by the way, he takes the bus. And, I know you're here to advocate for him. I'm sandwiched between two aunties, and it's, listen, only 2-on-1? You should make it 3-on-1, because it's still not a fair fight for you guys. And by the way, saying that, why don't we just all carpool? Yeah, thing is, that's a little bit racist. Because we all have our cars and our warm houses, and China's just getting caught up, and India's just getting caught up. And in 2009, we reached a tipping point where more cars were bought and sold in China than in the United States. And they're not going to listen to rich, luxurious Westerners, most of whom are white, like most of your speakers, saying you cannot have the Industrial Revolution that we had. They all want to be two-car families, too. And I think that's great, by the way, so they don't have to walk or bike. Environmental responsibility, peace, treatment of workers, and human rights. If you look at the world's sources of oil through these four liberal values, these are your values, Miguel, not my right-wing values, you will come to the conclusion I have. The Canadian ethical oil is the fair trade coffee of the world's oil industry. I'll prove it to you in my 3 remaining minutes. I only have 200 more slides. Environmental responsibility. I mean, come on, I got to defend this. I mean, I'm from Alberta. I mean, who could defend that kind of flaring? Or look at that, you could drop a match into that Fort McMurray River, it would burn. That's terrible. Look at that filmy oil. Look at that scarred land from seismic. Anyone here actually seen what seismic fracking does to the land? Look at that. And I got to defend that? I'm just kidding. That's Russia. That's flaring of gas in Russia. We don't allow that in Alberta. I got you, didn't you? Because you don't know. And that's the Niger River Delta. You know, 2,000 unremediated toxic oil spills in Nigeria will never be cleaned up. And no, that's not actually fracking. Fracking happens a mile underground. I'll tell you what that is a little bit later, if you care. That actually is the oil sands, though. It's mined. And if you listen to my friends like Mr. Guilbeault, they'll tell you the size of the oil sands covers landmass equivalent to Florida or the United Kingdom. And that is true. But only in 2% of the land area is the oil close enough to the surface to be mined that way. The other 98% of the land, it's too deep. And so this is how you get oil out of the oil sands in 98% of the geography. All that treed area where the critters are frolicking and birds are chirping, that's oil sands in production too. This is not a Greenpeace photo like my first one. This is not oil sands pornography, because this doesn't make someone cut a check to Greenpeace, does it? This is how most of the oil will be produced, because you cannot strip mine something 2 miles down. This is how most of it's produced. No tailings ponds needed. No fresh water needed. Now, I'm not anti-open pit mine. Here's one from BC. Here's from Timmins. I don't mean to embarrass you Quebecers, but you got a lot of ugly, ugly open pit mines, Malartic, Asbestos, Tetford. I'm not picking on you, but let me just say that in Alberta, it's a law that open pit mines have to be reclaimed. Now, that's not a law here in Quebec. I'm not looking down my nose at you. I'm just saying one day you'll catch up, and you will start to reclaim your money. We actually have oil companies have to lodge with the Alberta government $1 billion as insurance in case an oil company would go bankrupt, let's say. That $1 billion that's held by the government to clean it up. One day you guys will catch up. Total land disturbed by oil sands mining, 663 square kilometers. It's about one-tenth the size of Toronto. I regret that Toronto will never be reclaimed, but the oil sands all will be. Here's a before and after shot. In Quebec, it's sort of reversed, right? Because you guys don't clean up your open pit mines. We do in Alberta. This is an aftershot. Aftershot. This is the oil sands plant more trees in Canada than Greenpeace does, because Greenpeace doesn't plant trees. Water use. One barrel of mined oil sands, 105 gallons. That's a lot of water. A little bit less for the in situ. Hamburger, 634 gallons. Cotton shirt, pair of jeans, kilogram of beef. Oh, and Zoe, to make your one latte, it's 53 gallons of water to grow that bean and make it. I'm just trying to put the use in perspective. I know Mr. Gilbo doesn't like tailings ponds, but he only seems to criticize the ones in Canada, not in other countries like, say, Florida, three times as large. I'm going to whip through these because I really do have 80 slides left. I know photosynthesis is something they don't really teach in today's new learnings, but back when I was in school, CO2 was called plant food. But I'm not going to try and argue with you that the theory of man-made global warming is in trouble and there's been a 15-year hiatus in global warming according to the United Nations. I'm not going to try and pick that fight here today because we don't have time. What I will say to you is that the oil sands are a tiny trifle of that. 45 megatons of CO2, let's call it 50, out of Canada's 700 megatons, out of the man-made world's 23,000 megatons, out of the natural world's 770,000 megatons. In other words, this guy, speaking here at an OPEC conference, has convinced us that we are the problem, when in fact, per barrel, the amount of energy used in the oil sands has fallen 29% in the last 20 years. Comparison, all oil sands companies combined, 45 megatons. Individual coal-fired power plants in China, 42 megatons. Last thing, the power plant. That's real pollution, too. This is the single largest CO2 emitter in the world. This one power plant has more CO2 emissions than all oil sands combined. They're building two of these a week in China. You shut down the oil sands, it'll have a one-second pause in the emissions of CO2. What's the problem on this map? If you don't like dots, is the problem the blue dot of the oil sands or the red dots of U.S. coal? If you don't like dots, Europe's even worse. I'm just going to whip through this because I'm almost out of time. And I need to let you guys have 2-to-1 time to rebut me. I've got to be sandwiched between the antes. Okay, I will. I will. Oh, you know, let's talk about peace. So let's say I haven't convinced you that the oil sands are gentle on the environment. Let's say you actually believe that Nigeria has higher environmental standards than Canada. Let's say you actually believe that Saudi Arabia cares more about that Vladimir Putin at his Kremlin says, how can we get the CO2 per barrel? Let's say you believe that. Let's say I haven't convinced you. Okay, but you say you believe in peace. In Canada, we won the Nobel Prize for peacekeeping. We invented it. Saudi Arabia gave us 9/11 with their oil money, and 15 out of the 19 hijackers that day, according to Hillary Clinton, they're still the world's largest financier of terrorism. Iran is using its oil money to build nuclear weapons and the missiles to deliver it. Russia used its oil money to invade Georgia and maybe the Ukraine. Sudan, yeah, that wasn't fracking I showed you. That's actually a place called Darfur. A lot of oil in Sudan. They want to join OPEC. If you take the 300,000 people murdered in the genocide of Darfur, divided into the number of barrels of oil exported by Sudan over that same period of time, it works out to 6.5 milliliters of blood. There's 185 ounces of blood in the human body times 300,000 barrels of oil, 300,000 people, is 6.5 milliliters of blood per human body. That's about 1.5 tubes of lip silt, of lip balm. If this were full of blood, 1.5 of these of human blood per barrel of Sudanese oil. So there really is human blood out there. But, you know, we killed 1,600 ducks by accident when they sat down in a tailings pond. That made international news. There's a whole criminal trial, $3 million fine, that's $2,000 a duck. Those stupid ducks. I mean, those smart ducks. Those stupid Darfuris, I meant to say. If only they were ducks, maybe Greenpeace would have given a damn. I mean, come on, they're only in Darfur. They're only people. Which received more news from an oil perspective? The 300,000 men, women, and children murdered over oil in Darfur that Greenpeace doesn't give a damn about, or 1,600 ducks? I can polish off 50 at Wings Night. How about you? Which is more morally important? Well, the thing is, you can't make money for Greenpeace in Sudan. You can't campaign in Saudi Arabia. My friend Sipora Berman, who will speak after me, would be arrested in Saudi Arabia. She's a Jew. She's a woman who doesn't wear the full niqab. And, of course, this whole conference would be illegal in Saudi Arabia because we're criticizing oil. Those protesters, the two vegetarians and the anarchist who kept us out of here for an hour, they would be in prison now in Saudi Arabia. All of us would be on a government list. That is the moral difference between oil in an OPEC regime and oil in the gentlest country in the world. I have not heard a word today about the real oil producers, the largest oil producers, of which Canada is not one. Petroculture, what's the total oil and gas economy of our GDP? Is it even 5%? And yet I haven't heard a single criticism of Saudi Arabia. What's the largest oil company in the world? Anybody? Anybody? Exxon? BP? It's Saudi Aramco. It's bigger than Exxon, BP, and Shell combined. Where's your criticisms of Saudi Aramco? I'm not saying go there and break in and unfurl a banner like we did here today. You'd be killed. But could we at least maybe just set aside 5% of our rage for OPEC, which dominates the world industry? Is that okay? Can we do that? Can we set aside 5% of our loathing for our own country, for the OPEC butchers, before we get back to our self-hatred? Treatment of workers. Dubai. It's the world's tallest building. It's a big phallic symbol called the Burj Khalifa. Burj means tower. Khalifa is the name of the dictator. Very beautiful over there. Anyone here been to Dubai? Gleaming white towers. If you like gleaming white structures, you would have loved, you know, the Deep South in the 1850s. Just don't look at all the brown people building it, okay? Because you see, in places like the Persian Gulf, for every citizen, there's 1 million citizens of United Arab Emirates, but there's 4 million foreign indentured workers, almost all of them minorities, many of them fellow Muslims, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Philippines, Thailand, Palestinians, living in squalor, have their passport taken away, no civil rights, no right to... These are the people, there are 4 to 1 foreign indentured workers in UAE, in Saudi Arabia, to citizens. So I thought you cared about the workers, Zoe. Oh, and it's not just men, by the way, it's women. Maid locked up without pay for 17 years in Saudi. Saudi Arabia beheads women for witchcraft. Saudi Arabia's born witches. There are no witches, of course. That's just what you do with a foreign indentured worker who maybe caught the eye of the master of the house. Nigeria, they steal money. In Canada, we take money and we give it to protesters. This is how we treat protesters. I mean, Fort McMurray, how are workers in Fort McMurray treated? It's the richest city in Canada by income. And it's the most generous city in Canada, too, according to the United Way. I'm almost done. Human rights. I'll be really quick. That's the mayor of Fort McMurray, Melissa Blake, re-elected, I think, for her third term. Completely unremarkable to have a young woman mayor in Canada. I mean, it's not even noticeable, is it? I mean, especially Alberta, famous five, first woman magistrate in the whole British Empire. It's normal for us Albertans. How many young women mayors are there in Saudi Arabia, do you think? Well, there's none, because it's illegal, of course. It's legal to vote if you're a woman, legal to drive. If you're a woman, illegal to get elective surgery if you're a woman without the permission of your husband slash owner. Oh, it's illegal to be raped in Saudi Arabia. I said to be raped. That's the Sharia crime of adultery. And, of course, the punishment for that is stoning, Sharia style. That actually happens. This is a picture from Amnesty International in Iran. That's how they treat adulteresses in Iran. And, of course, an adulteress includes people who are raped. I'm almost done. Gays, too, according to the U.S. State Department, 4,000 to 6,000 gay men and lesbians have been hanged in Iran for the crime of loving someone that the Sharia law says they're not supposed to? No, I know you don't care. I mean, listen, it all burns the same in your gas tank, right? I mean, you don't even want to know what you're burning. I mean, you're Montrealers. You burn OPEC oil. I'm sorry to bring this to your attention. I'm from Alberta. We have stronger environmental standards. We have ethical oil. We don't hang gays. We have gay pride parades in Calgary. Aboriginal people, the number one employer of Aboriginal people in Canada is the oil sands. These are six-figure jobs. They're not fake work, make work projects. I know out east a lot of Indian bands were just sort of killed, but in the west we signed treaties, and we have about 2,000 Aboriginal people working directly for oil sands companies and over $1 billion a year in contracts. I'm out of time, and I don't want to take as much time as the two aunties together because that's not fair. We got to have it 2 or 3 to 1 here. I appreciate the invitation today, and if you believe in environmental responsibility, peace, the treatment of workers, and human rights, keep hoping for that dilithium crystal solution. Keep dreaming about that fantasy fuel of the future. Last slide. This really is the last slide. You know, that's Donald Trump on the right being touched inappropriately by Larry King. Donald Trump is the most un-Canadian man I know. He's not anti-Canadian, he's just un-Canadian, because so much chutzpah, so much braggadocio, isn't it? He wouldn't last long in this country. The problem is we've become the anti-Trumps. We're so shy, we're so meek, that we don't stand up to the real bullies. We allow the green pieces of the world to tell us that we're evil, we're immoral, we've got the petroculture, when in fact it's Saudi Arabia, Iran, Venezuela, Nigeria, and Sudan that are. So I think we need a little bit more Donald Trump in us. We need a little bit more self-respect. And the next time Greenpeace shits on our country, say, all right, fair deal, fair cop. Can you say one word today about OPEC? And I don't think they will. Thanks for your time, everybody.
Thank you. I think there's no question in my mind that we would have a lovely ensuing discussion, but you've gone over your 20 minutes, and our next speaker has to catch a plane. So we're going to move forward, and I would encourage those of you who do have questions for Mr. Levant, if you're staying a little bit longer, to please approach him directly. It's too bad, because I think that would have been quite a lively discussion. And I should also just mention Normand Mousseau, who is to be an industry representative on this panel, unfortunately did have to cancel. And so the original intent was certainly to have a variety of perspectives on the panel. It's my great pleasure to now introduce our next speaker, Sephora Berman. She's the former co-director of Greenpeace. She was also executive director and co-founder, or she is executive director, I should say, and co-founder of PowerUp, co-founder and campaign director of Forest Ethics Social Media Savant, and a lawyer. Dr. Berman has been designing and winning environmental campaigns in Canada and around the world for 20 years. She currently works as a strategic advisor for dozens of environmental organizations, First Nations, and philanthropists on clean energy, oil sands, and pipelines. She's the former co-director of Greenpeace International's Global Climate and Energy Program and co-founder and campaign director of Forest Ethics, as mentioned. She's been honored with inclusion into the permanent exhibit of the Royal BC Museum as one of 150 people who have changed the face of British Columbia. Her first book, This Crazy Time, Living Our Environmental Challenge, was published in English by Knopf Canada et en français par Vertes Années ou la vie d'une environnementaliste. So without further ado, I present to you Sephora Berman.
Thank you so much, and to the conference organizers for inviting me to join you. I was pulled out in the middle of that because of the time change for a media interview that I had committed to that was live. And at first I was extremely disappointed, but I actually believe it was really good for my blood pressure. I want to start today by talking about this morning, because I think it's too easy to write off protests because that particular one or those tactics or that particular message, you know, didn't seem right to you, or you were frustrated because you wanted to be in here in the conference. But as academics, as business leaders, as government decision makers, we need to look at trends. We need to look at history. There is no great social change in our history that didn't first see protests from civil society. Often civil society is ahead. They push us to review unjust laws, to look at policies that take longer to change. 20 years ago, I started this work by organizing logging blockades in British Columbia. I was charged by the BC government with 857 criminal charges. I faced 6 years in jail. At the time, one premier called me a terrorist. Another premier called me an enemy of the state. 10 years later, when we made an agreement to protect over 5 million hectares of those forests, to change forest practices, to change, in fact, the way forestry is done in British Columbia, something that they said was impossible and would destroy the province, I was called an eco-hero by the next premier for saying the same thing. Social change isn't linear. It happens at tipping point moments, and we are living one of those moments. And we should be looking at the trends, because while I think there are lots of mistakes that the climate movement made, especially in the run-up to Copenhagen, we earnestly argued about policy. Today, that has changed. And when I meet with farmers in Nebraska or First Nations in northern British Columbia or local community groups here in Quebec fighting Line 9, we are seeing a different face of a climate movement, one is stronger than ever before. So in a lot of ways, I thank those kids this morning and others like them who will be standing up across the country. So I was asked to speak on how safe is our oil. I'd like to touch briefly on the issues of transportation and then move on to both production and climate safety. I want to be clear, there are no fail-safe methods to produce or transport oil. From the Gulf of Mexico to Dalian, China, where in fact we do work on oil around the world, by the way. When I was the director of Greenpeace International's climate program, our team, Greenpeace team, were the first responders on site in the Gulf and in Dalian, China. We watched in horror as workers in Dalian literally drowned in oil. From Lac-Mégantic disaster to Kalamazoo last year, we are only too aware of the obvious safety issues with oil. If there's anything we've learned from these pipeline disasters in Michigan and Arkansas, it's that these pipelines represent a serious risk to our communities, that spills and leaks are not only common but expected, and that more often than not, citizens are evacuated. They're hospitalized, and we are left footing the bill. Just to look at one example, the US EPA estimates that over 1 million gallons of dilbit leaked into the Kalamazoo River. Cleanup has now surpassed $1 billion. 35 miles of the Kalamazoo River has been closed for 2 years. 50 households were evacuated immediately, 320 people hospitalized. The investigation identified a complete breakdown of safety at Enbridge. The spill went unaddressed for over 17 hours and was exacerbated by Enbridge failed response. This should be of concern to those of you here in Quebec. The Line 9 and Energy East pipelines proposed through Quebec go along the shores of the St. Lawrence River and many of its tributaries. This area is home to 80% of the population of Quebec. 50% of Quebecers get their drinking water from these water courses. If you believe the advertisements in Canada today, it's okay. It's all getting safer. The pipelines are getting thicker. The pipeline companies are more responsible. The oil sands companies have 100 new safety measures. Yet the spills continue, in part because the leading cause of spills on both land and water is something technology cannot fix. It's human error. Since 2000, only 13 years, there have been over 1,000 oil spills in Alberta alone. The safety incident rate has doubled in the last decade. Even without all of these disasters and spills, leakage is considered common and expected In Alberta alone, 3.4 million liters of fossil fuels are reported to have leaked without major spills or major reporting every year in Alberta. 3.4 million liters, because that's what one can expect. There are no fail-safe methods to transport oil or diluted bitumen over land or water. The Coast Guard analysis recently said that a major spill could be expected in Canadian waters every 7 years. So I think it's also important not to look at spill safety rates and accident rates, but also to look at what happens when one of them happens. And the industry and government reports say that we can expect at most between 15 and 25% cleanup. It's considered success. So 15% of cleanup of a spill is success. So that means 85% of toxic dilbit is left in our environment, and that's success. So when Stephen this morning was talking about risk and benefits, we are, as citizens, left with the majority of the risks. Also, when we talk about safety, I want to talk about human health, because I think that's absolutely critical. Stephen talked about the open pits. He talked about the toxic sludge that we're seeing growing at 300 million liters a day in Alberta. I think what is important for you to understand that is that we currently have no laws that govern the most dangerous toxic pollutants in Alberta. So when I was told this by scientists in Alberta, I thought, that can't be possible. That can't be possible. And so they went through the books with me. So one of the most dangerous toxins is naphthenic acids. So naphthenic acids are carcinogen, they're a neurotoxin. We have no limits. So when Environmental Defense found this out and they sent a letter to the federal government saying, why are we limiting this? The federal government replied back and said, well, we don't require industry to tell us how much they're putting into the environment, so we can't set a regulatory level. So we know that there are more than 1,400 known pollutants emitted by tar sands operations. We also know from studies in the last several years that mercury wafting out of the oil sands operations is now impacting an area up to 19,000 square kilometers. We know that levels of neurotoxins have been found near industrial operations up to 16 times higher than background levels within that 19,000 square kilometers. Federally funded research by some of Canada's top scientists found that levels of toxic hydrocarbons in six lakes were up to 23 times what they were before the mines were built. And now a new study suggests that environmental health risks of oil sands operations in Alberta's Athabasca regions have probably been underestimated. In 2008, Alberta Health confirmed a 30% rise of cancer rates between 1995 and 2006 in Fort Chippewa. When I talk about these issues internationally, people say what's happening in Canada is a tragedy. It's really horrible. We've heard about the First Nations people. We've heard from some of the chiefs speaking, etc. But meeting this summer with the chiefs in the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nations and the Beaver Lake Cree and being taken to where they used to fish, this is not a tragedy. A tragedy is a problem without a solution. A problem with a solution that's not being acted upon is not a tragedy. It's a scandal. And what's happening right now in Canada is a scandal. Scott Vaughan and others touched yesterday on the impacts that we're seeing to our democracy, the thousands of environmental assessments that have been cancelled as a result of the gutting of environmental laws. So I won't go over that territory, but I will say this. Our democracy is at risk in this country. Oil is not safe if we don't have environmental assessments for industrial projects, if we're not able to assess. Our democracy is not safe unless we have public participation, unless we have transparency, unless we have the information that we need to engage in the debate. And when the journal Nature, one of the most preeminent scientific journals in the world, says that in an editorial, it's time for Canada to set its scientists free, because our scientists are not allowed to release their reports to us, we know we have a problem. And of course, you know, in Bill C-38, we saw the weakening of so many laws. You know, we used to protect 2.5 million lakes and rivers in Canada. We now protect 62 rivers and 97 lakes with our laws. Someone earlier talked about the impact of the oil industry lobby. We know from documents revealed through access to information last year that we lost these laws because the oil industry asked for them to be removed, because they were in their way. The Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline alone would cross over 1,000 streams and rivers. So I want to actually specifically mention the changes to the NEB pipeline hearing review, because I know that you're going to be facing that in Quebec. We're currently facing it in British Columbia. The Enbridge Northern Gateway process, thousands of people participated. And I think regardless of what you think about pipelines, I think Canadians would agree that we have a right to this debate. And we have a right to the right debate. So in the NEB process, you are not allowed to talk about climate change. You are not allowed to talk about tar sands. This is a charter violation of our rights to free speech. Do you know, if you want to participate as a citizen now in the NEB pipeline reviews, you have to fill out an 11-page online form to see whether or not you'll be accepted to submit a one-page letter. And after you submit that form, right now in British Columbia, Kinder Morgan, the pipeline company, is allowed to review every application and argue to the board why that person or intervener should or shouldn't be allowed to be accepted. Do you know, the forms to apply to be a citizen in Canada are less than the forms right now to apply to participate in a pipeline hearing. I want to finish by talking just briefly about climate change. Stephen covered a lot of this ground, so I won't. But I do want to say that the IPCC report that came out last year changed the landscape, followed quickly by the World Bank report, by reports by MIT and many other universities talking about not just what we can emit, but how much we need to leave in the ground. That we need to leave two-thirds of our remaining carbon in the ground in order to have a safe climate. So, what we know, of course, over 500,000 people have lost their jobs, lost their lives this year due to climate change. The UN now tells us that by 2020, which 6 years from now, by 2020, agriculture yields in Africa could be reduced by 50%. These are safety issues that we've seen a dramatic rise and increase in storms. But specifically, I want to look at this, the World Energy Outlook. They say on planned policy, rising fossil energy use will lead to irreversible and potentially catastrophic climate change. We're on a 6-degree track. But they talk about the false economy. Delaying action for every dollar of investment in clean technology that's avoided right now, we'll spend $4 by 2020. So when we sit here yesterday and talk about the costs and compare the prices, say it's not realistic, we have to continue developing unconventionals, we need to keep this in mind. And this graph just really shows you where Canada is. The single reason Canada cannot meet our climate targets is the growth in emissions from the oil sands. And while I know the industry, our guests from Cenovus and others, like to make that seem so small in a global sense, I think what it's important to remember is that oil sands emissions have doubled in the last decade. They're set to double again in the next decade. And we have already approved in Alberta enough projects that the combined emissions of those projects on an annual basis would be equivalent to the combined emissions from 150 nations, over 1,000 metric tons of carbon. So people can play with the numbers all they want and say that it's a very small amount internationally, but the fact is, the reason people like Dr. James Hansen are being arrested, the head of climate of NASA arrested last year in front of the White House, is because they know that we cannot unlock this massive pool of carbon. We have a responsibility as Canadians to ensure that we leave the majority of the oil sands in the ground. I had this conversation last week with an industry executive. And he said to me, "Are you crazy? Are you saying you want to leave it in the ground? But we could make a killing. We don't need to make a killing in Canada. We need to make a living. Canadians deserve clean, safe jobs at home, where they live. And it is a crime, a scandal, that a generation of Canada's children are growing up watching the skies, waiting for mom and dad to get home from Fort Mac, from Vancouver Island to Halifax. Stephen talked to you about how we could have more jobs if we invested in clean energy. We could, in fact, have more jobs if we invested in any other sector in Canada, because the oil sands are the most capital-intensive sector in Canada. So we hear a lot, well, we all use oil. Yes, we do. But the majority of emissions come from heavy industry. The majority of emissions reductions and the reductions on our dependence from oil will come from legislation. It's not about feeling guilty that you have to drive to work. We don't just need better light bulbs, we need better laws. And the fact is that if we had vehicle efficiency legislation equivalent to what Europe is proposing right now, 95 grams, our cars would use 50% less oil. We know that we have had more changes in the last 2 years on clean energy than we have had in the last 20. We know that the last 2 years were the first 2 years in human history where new investment in renewables exceeded for electricity generation new investment in coal, oil, and nuclear combined. So when you hear those arguments that it's too difficult, that we can't do it, you need to remember that it's already happening. It's happening all over the world. We are living the tipping point moment where we will re-envision industrial society to ensure that it is cleaner, that it is safer, that we are protecting communities and providing jobs where people live. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Very compelling presentation. Thank you very much for providing a presentation based on science and evidence. Sorry. Just saying. If that's a bias, to be biased in favor of science, so be it. We do actually have a couple of minutes for questions, so I'd ask you to be extremely pointed, and we're going to take them like one after the other, and I know Sephora has to catch a flight. So,
in orange shirts, ask me about divestment, because I didn't get to it.
Okay. All right, so we're going to do rapid fire. You might want to take some notes, because we're just going to do them one after another. We'll actually start on the right this time.
Hi, my name is Melissa Aronchik. I'm a researcher at Rutgers University in the States. I noticed you had a quote from Mike DeSouza, environmental reporter for Post Media. I understand he's just been laid off along with four other journalists. They've closed the parliamentary desk at Post Media. I wondered if you were familiar with this and if you were also following the story. There's been some discussion that it's connected to the relationship Post Media has with CAP. So I just wondered if you could comment on that.
Question number one. Number two.
I'm from the University of Michigan. I hear in your talk a kind of rewriting of the question, who owns our oil? We've heard about First Nations, Alberta, Canada, but I hear a kind of planetary stakeholder here in terms of the consequences. And I also hear you say basically a rebuttal to the idea of Canadian exceptionalism, that a democracy can handle oil in a better way. And the most powerful thing I've heard since I've been here is your statement that it's not my democracy, but your democracy is at risk. And I just wanted you to say more about that in terms of the ways that democracy can be reclaimed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We're now out of time, but we'll take the remaining questions. Please go ahead.
I'm Marcia Bisyakov. I'm an author and a filmmaker and also an academic at Ryerson University. It seems like one of the themes of this conference is what is the role of humanities in the debate and the discourse around oil. So I wonder if you could speak to that. What do you feel the role of humanities academics or artists are? What examples can you provide around
Thank
that?
You. Felix.
Hello. Just very quickly, what should the debate or conversation be from your perspective? And if you were the good Judge Solomon, what should the outcome be?
Okay, great last question. I'm so sorry. She has to literally leave in 4 minutes to catch her flight. Sephora, over to you.
My son's play is this evening, his annual play, and he's the lead. So if I'm not back in Vancouver by 7 p.m., then I have broken my commitment to my little boy. So I'm going to be on that plane. I want to address the last first. I think the most one of the quickest things we can do right away would be to eliminate fossil fuel subsidies in Canada. We currently give $1.2 billion a year to the most profitable companies on the planet. Shell made $1 billion last month. So I think if we actually started to get rid of those, we'd start to have a level playing field. We see that happening. We would also see that happening internationally. There are many international bodies that have called for that. There's no question that we need a price on carbon. Polluters should have to pay for what they're doing. That would dramatically decrease the rate and pace of expansion if we actually had a price on carbon, as well as water regulations that I referred to yesterday. And other regulations that would slow down expansion. We need to cap the expansion of the oil sands now. The IEA, I had to skip that slide, actually estimates that if we want to keep the world below 2 degrees at safe climate levels, we can't have more than 3 million barrels a day of oil sands production. And our government is proposing 9 million barrels a day, 5 million by 2020. So that would take us past safe climate levels. We need to cap the production of the oil sands right away. We do need to ensure that we have better regulations to at least have more responsible oil sands while they exist, because they're poisoning people. And then I think what we need to do is transition away from oil and oil sands in our economy. It's not going to happen overnight, but there's no question that it can happen with the electrification of transport and more investment in public transport, et cetera. So I would see that as kind of a package. I think we should be looking at exporting clean electrons as an export for Canada. So literally renewable electricity in some regions. We should be investing in the grid to make sure that happens. What can we do for our democracy? Vote and try and encourage more people to vote. I don't think this is a right or left issue. We've seen climate leadership around the world from the most surprising places. Arnold Schwarzenegger, who would have thought he would have been our climate leader? I don't think this is a right or left issue. I think it's a right or wrong issue. I think we should be encouraging all parties to have the right policies in the climate era and encouraging more and more people to engage and vote. I think we should support organizations that are trying to do that and trying to raise these important issues. I would say organizations like Lead Now in Canada, many others who are doing that important work. I think the fact is we need to recognize that oil corrodes. It's corroding our pipelines, but it's also corroding our democracy. And it's affecting every aspect of Canada's democracy right now, whether or not we can participate, our laws, our information, our scientists, and our science. The best resource for that is Andrew Nikiforuk, who is a brilliant author who's written several books on this topic. I do think that carbon resources are now a global commons issue in the climate era, and we're starting to see that conversation happen. Now, how we decide if we have to keep two-thirds in the ground, how much each country can do, there's questions of whether that's on GDP or on population. On either metric, Canada ends up keeping two-thirds of the oil sands in the ground, by the way. Mike D'Souza, I can't comment on whether there's a connection, but if you haven't seen it, I think it's worth looking at the agreement between Post Media News and CAP that the Vancouver Observer posted and broke yesterday. I think the fact is that it shows, well, it clearly says, Post Media says that they will ensure that their articles and editorial bents support CAP's energy agenda. I think the public actually deserves independent reporting in this country. I want to finish, before I run from my plane, by addressing divestment, because I've heard a lot of some disparaging comments by professors and others here about the divestment movement. And I really do want to say that divestment is no longer a fringe idea. When Storebrand, a Scandinavian asset manager, announced that they were going to divest $74 billion from coal last year, it became an entirely different ballgame. 4 days ago, philanthropic foundations with the combined assets of $2 billion announced they were divesting entirely from fossil fuels and investing in clean energy. We have over 20 universities. We have over 30 religious institutions. Nine universities, 23 major cities, 20 religious institutions, all already committing to divest. I think Reverend Lennox Jr., in his speech on divestment from the Hill during the protest where 50,000 people protested tar sands pipelines in Washington last year, said it best. He said, "My generation in the civil rights movement, my parents' generation, marched for equality. Today in the divestment movement, our children are marching for existence." The divestment movement is a sign of things to come. Academic institutions, our responsibility in academic institutions is to help build leadership, to show that we, the world to come, to educate. How are we preparing our students for the future if we're unwilling to lead? I support the divestment movement here at McGill. I urge McGill to ensure divestment. It's only 5% of your holdings. You can do it, and you should do it. Thank you.
Thank you all for a great a series of presentations, and I think we're taking a little bit of a break. Merci, on va prendre une petite pause santé.